Vision 2020 UK.
Welcome to the Vision 2020 UK podcast. In this edition of the podcast, presented by me, John Wellsman, we're in conversation with
Rachel Pilling, consultant ophthalmologist at Bradford Teaching Hospitals.
Getting an understanding of and support for people with a combined sight loss and learning disability. But before we delve into that, let's find out more about Rachel.
So I qualified as an ophthalmologist in 2009, and as part of that, I was part of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists working party in learning disability in 2008 as a trainee, and became really opened my eyes into the world of learning disability at that stage. So then in 2011, the Learning Disability Committee of Vision 2020 were looking for an ophthalmologist, and I seemed to be a good fit. My background in paediatric ophthalmology was a good primer, so assessing patients who may not be verbal, may not be able to explain what their vision problem is, and coming from Bradford, we have a very large special needs population in schools. So we just went and found out more about what was going on locally and then fed that into the committee. Certainly in Bradford, we have a learning disability eye group. We're very privileged to have what's nationally recognised as a community learning disability healthcare team, and an optometrist and an orthoptist who find a case find in the community and just linking it into what we do in the hospital. And then also special school visual assessments. Again, we've been pioneering in our approach to going and finding children in special schools and offering visual assessments.
I want to break this down a bit further, if I can. But before we do that, I want to find out more about what we define as a learning disability.
There are many different dictionary definitions, if you like. One of the ones that the Department of Health use at the moment is someone who finds it difficult to adapt to new situations, finds it difficult to tackle complex tasks. Somebody who may or may not have a physical and communication disability as well. Traditionally, people have looked at IQ testing and said IQ less than 70, but not many of us in real world are looking at IQs. What it's perhaps more useful to say is it's something that's come on before adulthood, that it's not things like dyslexia, which is a learning difficulty. It's not autism, although many people with autism do have a learning disability. It's not dementia or mental health, although many of the principles apply to those populations.
So it's quite a complex issue then, isn't it? And is it, from your experience and the experience you have with your colleagues, easy to define within those parameters, or is that quite a difficult task?
I think from the background of paediatric ophthalmology, it's quite easy. We see these children coming through from the paediatric clinics. So children with Down syndrome, there's a specific pathway for referral. Children with cerebral palsy or ex-premature children, they are identified at the paediatric assessment level if their development is not normal. I think what we've struggled with is that 20 years ago, that sort of thing didn't happen. So there is a large population of adults with learning disability who may not be known to any service or may just be cared for very well by home carers or paid carers who have never been through any sort of visual assessment system. And so it's finding those patients is the challenge and offering them the opportunities that we offer to other patients.
Now, people listening to the podcast are aware that this is a Vision 2020 UK podcast, so vision impairment being the sort of the prime directive. So what is the relationship then between learning disability and vision impairment?
Well, Seeability and RNIB published some work 2013 showing that people or adults with learning disability are 10 times more likely to have severe visual impairment than the rest of the population. And 6 out of 10 adults with learning disability would need glasses. Seeability has done some further research finding that children with special needs are 28 times more likely to have a vision problem than their peers who are typically developed. Those are quite stark numbers. 28 times feels a very big number to be working with.
So what are some of the day-to-day challenges then that are faced by people with a combined learning disability and sight loss?
I've already discussed that part of learning disability is a difficulty adapting to new environments and to new challenges. For anybody who loses sight or has poor sight, it has an impact on mobility. able to get around new environments or their home environment, on communication, understanding people, interpreting facial gestures, and on self-care. But for someone with learning disability, those are compounded. Other issues are related to how you would discover that person has a vision problem or a change in vision. There are real issues with diagnostic overshadowing, so a patient's change in behaviour, so frustration or irritation or seeming forgetfulness or loss of ability at tasks, is put down to an underlying learning disability or early dementia, rather than being considered that vision may be the reason that this person is having difficulty doing things they used to. If you lack communication, you can't tell someone that you can't see properly. And very much in our awareness is that carers, paid carers, excellent family carers, are unaware of the change in vision. So where you might imagine that it would be easy to pick a change in vision up, it really isn't. Carers don't know that there's been a change, and we need to proactively look for vision problems. I'll give you a couple of case examples. So a lady who we saw, who we'll call Patricia, who had become, she was in her 50s, become progressively cantankerous, for want of a better word, refusing to get out of bed, refusing to wash and dress herself, refusing to feed herself. By the time she got to me, she was really wheelchair bound, sat bent over. She'd been diagnosed with a scoliosis, a curvature of the spine, because her neck was bent over towards her chest. We examined her, found she had very poor vision due to cataracts, performed surgery, and the next day she was running up and down corridors.
Oh, fantastic.
She was stealing food off other care residents' plates. She was become a real problem in that she would pinch people's bottoms. So this lady, who was thought to be wheelchair bound with a scoliosis, had nothing of the sort. She just couldn't see.
Wow.
So I can give you a child example as well. So a young boy we called Mohammed, again, was thought to have good days and bad days in school. He was 8 years old, and they felt this was due to partial seizures, as they're called, or absences. Well, actually, we went in and discovered that the child had no vision on his left-hand side, so had what we'd call a hemianopia, so that side of the visual field doesn't work. So if in his wheelchair he was parked up with his right side against the wall, he was then having to use his left visual field, which didn't work, to look at the room, which didn't work, so he didn't engage with the class because he couldn't see anything. If he was fed from his left-hand side at lunchtime, he couldn't see the fork coming towards him and wouldn't eat. But if you just turned his chair so his left side was against the wall, all of a sudden the world is there for him and he was engaged and would feed. So really very simple things can be highlighted to a carer in order to transform that patient's world and highlight that the change they'd seen was not due to the underlying disability or mental state or seizures. It was actually that they couldn't see.
Now, there's some of the simpler, more practical ways of challenging some of the issues that are faced by a group of people with learning disability and sight loss. How complex an issue is it from your perspective in your sort of medical world, assessing the needs of someone with combined sight and learning disability?
I think there's two big issues to tackle, mainly about barriers. So there's lots of talk of barriers to accessing healthcare for people with disability, learning disability, vision problems, or across the board. But the barriers exist in two directions. One of the big issues we found is that healthcare put up barriers. The "I don't have time to do this" barrier, the "oh, it's too difficult," or "I don't have the training and the skills." And we're trying to work with these by providing resources for people so that it doesn't take so long, or there are ways that to split the appointments up so it can be done in shorter parts, to introduce training into optometry, into universities, into learning disability healthcare teams, and into ophthalmology training. The second is the barriers that the carers themselves unwittingly put up. I call it misguided kindness. There are assumptions made that a visit to the opticians would be too stressful, that there's nothing that could be done for someone who doesn't read or mobilise. Why would they need vision? There are lots of assumptions made. We need to do a lot of myth busting so that you don't need to be able to read or speak to have a sight test as an optician. There are lots of part of the tests that we can do which don't require cooperation in that way. And we need to get that word out into the learning disability community. We can train as many optometrists, ophthalmologists as we can, but until the carers are aware that it's important and indeed possible to test vision, then we're not going to make the breakthroughs that we want. There are very simple things that can be done. So certainly locally, our residential homes or care homes for people with learning disability bring patients in pairs. So one will have their sight tested, they've been before, and their companion will just sit in the waiting room. So they've been to the optometrist, they've seen someone then go in and come out unscathed. When they go and have the glasses fitted, they'll go and sit and perhaps try a pair on themselves. So when it's their turn to have their sight tested, this isn't new. That costs nothing, but is a great way of opening this world.
And have there been things, given your background in the teaching hospital, that you've done and you've explored and things that you found actually work for you in your role?
So one of the things we learned through the Special School Visual Assessment Programme is that the visual assessment tools that we have don't work for a lot of children or adults, particularly those with complex disabilities. So we developed the Bradford Visual Function Box, which just was things I found in my daughter's toy box. So little beads of different sizes, working from 5 millimetres up to a large flashing ball that's about 10 centimetres. And we put them on very fine bits of craft wire so you can dangle them in front of a patient and look and see if they are seeing it. A lot of the visual tools that we have are a bit boring and bland and grey because they're scientific based, but you can't really assess vision. The advantage of the Bradford Visual Function Box is that you can then tell someone not what their scientific grating, how many cycles per degree the patient sees, but that they see objects that are 5 centimetres size or bigger. That means that the food on their plate needs to be 5 centimetres size, that the toys that you give a child need to be 5 centimetres or bigger. We can also track progress. So for young infants with poor vision, we can show the parent that the intervention that they're doing, the work they're doing, is making a difference. The child is definitely seeing more than they were before. And again, pre and post cataract surgery, we can demonstrate that there has definitely been an improvement in vision, even if we can't measure it on the traditional letter chart.
It sounds like a very practical and solution to something that can be quite a complex, not only complex situation in terms of the task you're asking someone to do, but in a sense the environment as well, isn't it? Because going in and having an eye test can be quite frightening for people.
Very much so. And we know that the anxiety often makes people behave in ways that they're not at their best. Mm. So you have to perform for an eye test. You have to show someone what you can do. And if a child or an adult is in a new environment, often they're not performing at their best.
And do they know the rules to start off with?
Well, do the ophthalmologists or the optometrists know the rules? So that's one of the things for patients with autism. Not all patients, but some patients can't see the room the way that other people would. They need to explore by touch. They need to walk in and touch every object in the room, orient themselves in a room, and then they'll sit and settle. Well, if you allow the person to do that, then you can get a lot more out of them, for want of a better term. Mm. But often we find the carers are desperate to make them sit down. No, you mustn't touch, yes. You mustn't touch. Yeah. But actually experience, and all of this has been experience-based. I learnt by doing it wrong and thinking, no, we need to do this differently. Yeah. That actually you can allow people just to explore. You might not get much of a vision test on day one, but when they come back next time, they'll feel more relaxed because they remember they've been here before and it wasn't as bad as they thought, or this was a safe environment. So lots to learn through reducing carer anxiety. Seeability have got a huge amount of patient and carer information leaflets. If the carer knows what may be happening on the day of the sight test, they can then prepare the patient or prepare themselves.
I presume also by purely letting the patient wander around the testing room and feeling the equipment or looking at the equipment, you can get some idea of what they can and can't see, but just simply by that very simple exercise of letting them explore.
Absolutely. I would say that more than 50% of my assessment is watching. So I'll watch the patient from the waiting room walk into clinic, because that'll tell me if they can mobilise independently in a new environment or not. When we go into special school, we walk down to the classrooms and watch the children, watch them in their natural environment. One of the schools we go into has a lift with a mirror in it, and to go up to the examination room. And one little boy who was thought to have no vision at all, we walked into the lift and he, from a metre and a half away, he looked at himself in the mirror and just brushed his hair the way young men do, just checking his every hair was in the right place. And Louise, my orthoptist, and I looked at each other and went, what a child can see.
Vision 2020 UK has a learning disability and sight related committee. Can you tell me more about the work of the committee?
Absolutely. It's a first thing to say, it's a multi-professional, and part of one of the things we pride ourselves on is that it's from people across sectors, so lots of input from the voluntary sector, from Seeability, RNIB, guide dogs, but also from the Royal College of Ophthalmologists, from the College of Optometrists, from ABDO, dispensing opticians and orthoptists, and our patient and carer reps who have from time to time visited and helped. It's really a space for us to come together and share the experiences and challenges in order to offer different solutions and perspectives. We found it's important to support each other in various initiatives that we come up with. So we'll peer review things that we wish to publish and check. Invaluably to me, really, is a sounding board for the work that I've wanted to pursue. It's not just me banging this drum. There's lots of other people banging it as well.
And do you feel that the makeup of the committee is dynamic enough to really get a maybe even a fresh sense of what the issues are and how to resolve those?
I feel we've done a good work on that over the last 6 years, certainly. We each have our areas outside the committee that we work in and bring fresh ideas in. I've learned that there's no point in me personally writing a guideline. There's no, even if it's endorsed by our Royal College, it needs to be endorsed by multi-agencies in order for people to think this is relevant to them. Communication and sharing information with our key audience, which we've learned is not just the professionals, it's the patients themselves, is really important. And the Vision 2020, all the member organisations, gives us a fabulous opportunity to, at the click of a button, share with 100 organisations who can then give us feedback or can then share with people who they are engaged with.
So let's dip into some of the work of the committee, and one of the work strands is key messages about vision for children with special needs. Can you tell me more about that?
This came out of a sense of frustration from many of us that we'd done an awful lot of work on what should happen, but it was translating that into real practice. People don't have time to read 20-page documents. They need something short and snappy. I met a child in clinic who had moderate learning disability, had good communication. English wasn't his mum's first language, and he wasn't wearing his glasses. And he knew he could see better with his glasses. His mum knew he could, but for some reason wasn't wearing them all the time. And she said, but when? And I looked at him, I said, if you've got your socks on, you should have your specs on. And that is a very short way of him knowing, right, I know exactly when I should have my glasses on now. So socks on, specs on appeared. And then we batted these round, is that we know that children or people can hear better if they can see better. So again, see well, hear well, a very quick little sticker with a picture of an ear and a picture of glasses on. We've produced 4 or 5 of these that now we take into special schools and we attach to the child's wheelchair or we attach to their personal communication. So everyone in contact with that child understands the importance of vision. It's been made a huge difference to our schools locally in the way that specs are considered. They're not an add-on, they are an essential.
You've also done work on adding learning disability to the sight registration forms, CVIs and other type of forms. Can you tell me more about that?
So we mentioned earlier on that we know that people with adults with learning disability are 10 times more likely to have severe vision problems. But we don't have raw data to back that up. We know from extrapolating from data elsewhere, we don't have a way of measuring that in the UK. The CVI forms are a fabulous resource, and by adding a simple drop-down menu, we can record that, not just for learning disabilities, but for dementia and other issues. That will give us a way of measuring over the coming years how well we're doing, measuring and making people, every time they look at the CVI form, that, oh, maybe that person with a learning disability should be registered. It's increasing an awareness that even if you can't read or speak, you can still benefit from sight impairment registration.
And do you think the eye health professionals who are basically filling in those forms on behalf of the individual, get a sense of the importance of learning disability and other elements of disability impairment because they are added to the form?
I would imagine on an individual level, no. They'll think this is yet another box to tick. But if we don't have it on, then we're not going to make a change. I think most of the change will come through our iClinic liaison officers. Certainly we work very hard with them to help us identify patients who could benefit from support. And even there aren't very many people out there like myself who have a special interest in learning disability, but I think that's the right thing. I think it should be on everybody's agenda. If the iClinic liaison officers are able to flag this up with the consultant staff, then again, it will raise awareness.
Fitting of spectacles. I know from my past life of having been partially sighted and needing spectacles that that's quite challenging at the best of times. What's the work the committee's done there?
We've produced a document called Spectacle Mishaps in Learning Disability. This is reflective of one of the recurrent themes, is that nobody deliberately does things an incorrect way in people with learning disability. Nobody sets out to be discriminatory or to forget to do reasonable adjustments. It just happens. An example is of a lady who went with her paid carer to have glasses fitted. They were fitted by the receptionist. If you aren't partially sighted or blind and if you're not a child, then the glasses don't have to be fitted by someone with any special qualification. Mm. We're trying to lobby to make changes to that. So because they were fitted by a receptionist, they didn't appreciate that the way the person's head in the wheelchair would matter. So when the glasses were put on, the ear bar was pushed forwards by the back of the chair, so the glasses were on wonkily, for want of a better word. The patient then didn't like the glasses, was irritated by them, and so the carer discarded them and then decided that all patients with a learning disability can't get on with glasses. So it didn't just make a difference for that patient, but for all the patients that that paid carer looked after.
And so what has been the work you've done to sort that out? How have you created messages around the appropriate fitting of glasses?
So we've produced a series of case stories that we're publishing on the website, that we're including in the University of Ulster and University of Bradford teaching schemes for learning disability optometry as part of the undergraduate optometry courses. And we're hoping to use them as part of lobbying for some changes to the legislation for sight tests for people with learning disability and also for spectacle fitting for people with learning disability.
Talking of legislation, we managed to get free eye tests for people with learning disabilities?
We're lobbying hard for that. It's part of a suite of changes that we're hoping to put together that would also include sight tests in school for children with learning disability, that they could be paid for in the same way that a sight test at an optician's is paid for by someone else. The vast majority of people with adults with learning disabilities certainly would be on benefits which would already entitle them to a free sight test, but by no means all adults. And we feel that a special exception should be made for this vulnerable group, that not having £20 should not be the barrier between that patient being able to access vision in the way that other people could.
And how successful do you think your lobbying will be?
Well, we've got NHS England are working actively with Seeability and, a core of people across sectors. We're meeting monthly and we have a deadline of October to get the business case together. So time will tell. There's a lot of legislation that needs to be changed for other reasons, for Brexit at the moment. But this is the closest we've ever come and there seems to be a lot of will behind it, that this is a good thing to do, this is the right thing to do.
Thinking of the future of the committee, do you get some sense of some long-term goals, some long-term aims for the committee's work, and what would you like those to be?
Personally, I would like to see that in 10 years' time we don't need a learning disability subcommittee, that learning disability is considered in the same way as everyone else, so we don't need to lobby for these changes, that sight tests happen for every child in school every year, that every adult with learning disability sees an optician every 2 years, that we don't need to push for this, that it just becomes something that just happens. Perhaps on a more reality check basis, we're working with Seeability with the legislation, that we have a work plan involving improving contact with GPs and with annual health checks. So all adults with a learning disability have a general, an MOT, if you will, every year, and vision is part of that. So So linking that into the community services that are available. And we're working with other resources, particularly social care. So again, vision is part of their regular checks, things that they ask about, and simple questions that anybody can ask that might help them identify if someone has a problem with their vision.
You belong to a body called the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. They do quality standards work, and quality standards, I know, are really important in the health and social care sector at the moment. Tell me about their work around learning disability.
So through the committee, we published some quality standards. This is a self checklist, if you will. 10 items that we encourage every eye department to look at and see, do they think they're fulfilling these? Simple things that largely cost no money that would make a big difference to somebody being able to access services. Things like the patient's able to choose the time of appointment rather than being issued it through the post. Things like the patient being offered a quiet place to sit. If you've ever been to an eye clinic, you know how busy and noisy they can be. So offering a quieter environment to sit, for them to be seen as soon as possible rather than join the raft of queues to have vision tested that perhaps might not be appropriate for them. That people think about low vision and certificate of visual impairment. Again, a key case for me is a young man called Graham who was offered a pink ping pong ball by our ECLO and part of his low visual aid assessment. For him, putting that ping pong ball into his glass of water made him realise how much water he had drunk and whether his glass needed refilling, and in fact that he could go and refill it himself because he could see how much water he'd put in the glass. So that's improving his mobility, that's improving his independence. Very simple things can make a big difference.
Now, challenging these quality standards, and let's take the eye clinic example, how can you make that special provision for that one group of people? And could we broaden the argument out and actually say, if you're going to do it for that group, why not reconsider how eye clinics run in the first place and do that for everybody?
I think you're absolutely right, and I know that many areas, as part of collaboration in eye care, that self-help and self-care, are moving to appointment systems where the patient would ring in and choose. The slight hiccup there for learning disability is you're not relying on the patient, relying on their carer to ring in and choose the appointment. But I think certainly with the way that the demands on eye care are going, is that a lot more will need to be done across the board to encourage patients to help them help themselves. So community self-help groups, for instance, for things like dry eye, where patients don't need to come to the hospital to be asked, are you using your drops, are you having problems? But actually a patient expert in the community can be part of that support network of saying, oh, I found this resource, this really helped me, or that really helped me. So I think there's lots of things that are being done across the board to mean that hospital eye care is for those people who need to come to hospital, and community eye care, which would be great for people with learning disability, closer to home, quieter environments, will become much more of a part of what we provide.
You've got peer support there as well, haven't you? So possibly getting a group of people who find themselves supporting people with learning disability, getting together and sharing their knowledge and experience.
Absolutely, and it's been shown in other healthcare areas to be far more valuable than a trip to the hospital. Certainly in terms of, you know, finding a parking space and the time it's spent queuing to get through. Actually, the time spent with the doctor is a very small fraction of the time a patient spends attending to their healthcare. If we can add more value by more of that time being spent actually addressing what the patient wants. There's a mantra where instead of asking people what's the matter, is asking what matters to you. And I think there's a lot to be learned from that.
Now, Rachel, we like award winners, and in 2015 you won something called the Asprey Award. Do you want to tell me more about what the Asprey Award is and what you did to win that? I think we've already touched on it already.
So I was very honoured to win the Asprey Award, which is run by Vision 2020 UK, and is acknowledgement of collaboration in eye care. So Vision 2020, as we know, is an umbrella organisation that brings different people in different groups together, and it exemplifies how doing this work on my own would not have happened. So we won the award, and I say we because I do think it's me and the team, well, won the award for the work we've done in special schools. So we had a funding bid to see every child in our three special schools who weren't already under the eye clinic. So we saw nearly 200 children over the course of 2 years and found that there were one in five of those children had severe visual problems. previously undiagnosed in 6 of them. No one had known that they were sight impaired, and that we found 1 in 3 children had some sort of visual problem, either needing glasses or other support to use their vision to its best. So this was a hidden population. The other aspect was to do with the work we'd done with adult learning disability. So the community team that I work with, where we make many, many reasonable adjustments. Alan is a key story we talk about. Alan's got severe learning disability and is blind in one eye and partially sighted in the other eye, and will not engage with anybody, and he likes to sit on the minibus that his care home have, and he will only be examined on the minibus, so I go and examine him on the minibus. That's what we do. We brought him to theatre to do a more in-depth check of his eye, and we had 17 health professionals in the room. We had someone taking blood, somebody doing an ECG, someone doing a haircut, somebody doing podiatry, somebody looking at his ears, I looked in his eyes. We made a whole list of reasonable adjustments for him, including not putting on hospital wristbands, not making him change out of his own clothes, having the pre-assessment take place at his home, not in the hospital. And from his case, we're able to show the large menu of things that can be done that really cost no money, that can make the difference between a successful interaction for healthcare with a patient and one which seems very hard work for everybody.
And do you think that's doable in general? Do you think that, not only in the health sector, because I'm sure it cuts across a lot of other elements of society, that we're very fixed sometimes in our ways of seeing things? You know, this is the way it's always been done, this is the way it's going to be done now, and we really do need to think out of the box a bit more.
Absolutely. I think that we're very protocol and guideline driven. We're very, but it has to be done this way. I think the way the Equality Act was written was really very empowering, making a reasonable adjustment. So a reasonable adjustment for a patient can be that they don't have to wear a hospital gown. A reasonable adjustment for a patient can be that they don't have to have a mark made on them to show which bit of their body we are looking at, if that would distress them. A reasonable adjustment is allowing them to use picture tests, not letter tests, to have their vision checked. There's many ways that we can use reasonable adjustments, and if people sit back for a moment and put themselves in the place of the carer, or just ask the carer, then we can find out what we would do differently. Certainly for learning disability, I've discovered that the carers wouldn't think of speaking up, particularly perhaps in a hospital environment, to a consultant, because they feel they don't want to tell me how to do my job. I hope that for many of their cases, I empower them to tell me how it is I should be doing this. Tell me what that patient will and won't tolerate. Tell me what will and won't work. Or I can offer you some options and you tell me which of these might be best.
If we broaden your work out for a second, the step away maybe a bit from learning disability, do you think there's anything you've gleaned from your work and your understanding of the complexities of some of the things you've been trying to crack, that there's any lessons for society in general?
That if you improve the vision of a patient with learning disability, you don't just improve their life, you improve the lives of everybody around them. I have an example of Jill, who came for cataract surgery. She had mild learning disability, lived with her sister. She was in her 40s, lived with her sister, and because of failing vision, she would no longer be left in a room on her own. We took Jill's cataracts out, and the next day she was back to doing jigsaw puzzles, watching telly. Her sister could not only prepare a meal in the other room, but could go back out to the shops in order to do the shopping for them. So we've improved not just Jill's life, but the life of her sister. And actually, in terms of society, we've reduced the care package that Jill is going to need long term. Another thing that I try and hammer home to people is that you only need to get it right one patient at a time. We're very big on writing far-reaching policies and going out to consultation and dotting I's and crossing T's. Just think about that person in front of you and get it right for that one person, and you will have learned something.
So you think that notion of a person-centred approach to everything is, from your perspective, very effective?
It is. And again, I find when I talk to different groups of people that most of the ideas that I put forward are about making it easier for you, the professional. So I make it easier for me by making sure the patient hasn't waited 20 minutes and lost patience. It makes it easier for me to examine them. I make it easier for me by finding out lots of information about the patient before they walk into the room, so I don't have to spend a lot of time asking questions. I make it easier for me by finding a vision or developing a vision test that gives me the information that I need. So very selfishly, actually, all of what I've done has been about making it easier for me to provide better healthcare and better eye care for somebody else.
Am I listening to a number of ophthalmologists and other eye health care professionals shouting at their iPods at this point saying, Rachel, that's all well and good and fantastic blue sky thinking, but let's get real about the day-to-day situations we find ourselves in hospitals, overcrowding, increasing patient numbers in the elderly population?
Absolutely, and what I would say back to them is if they have a patient in clinic who is diagnosed with, for instance, an eye cancer, they will willingly, in fact, wouldn't consider for a second not giving that patient an extra 20 minutes, an extra half an hour to discuss the diagnosis, to deal with the psychological aspects of what they've just said, to bring the patient back a week later to ask more questions. This is exactly the same thing.
And if we broaden, finally, the world of vision impairment right out, and from just your experience of working in the vision impairment organisation and from your experience of working in the hospital, what do you think, if you had any messages for society, you would want to say to society if you had the opportunity to talk to professionals, politicians and the like?
I don't want to see the same problems in 20 years' time, so we have to start at the bottom end. So we have to start by getting it right for children. We have to start by integrating the importance of vision into every aspect of a child's development and learning. If we do that, we'll help people see the importance of vision and how much better people can cope with the best vision there is for them. You need to imagine that it was you who was the care or patient. And what would you want? How would you want to be treated? And it's very easy to say, and we're all taught in exams to imagine it's your grandmother who's sitting in front of you. How would you want her to be treated? It is the same thing. People with learning disabilities have the same fears and have the same anxieties and have the same worries and troubles as everyone else. Just because you can't say that out loud or put it in language does not mean that you aren't troubled by the fact that you can't see properly, that you can't see to feed yourself or clothe yourself. That everybody has the right to be the best person they can. And we as healthcare professionals or as people involved in that site's community have a duty to do everything we can to enable them to access those services.
Rachel Pilling, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Vision 2020 UK.
For more information about this podcast, Vision 2020 UK and its members, get in touch via email
info@vision2020uk.org.uk,
on Twitter
@vision2020uk,
or via our website
www.vision2020uk.org.uk.
Produced by me, John Wellsman, at Sparrow's Rest.